So this talk tonight is called Nothing to Do. Nothing to Do. And its subtitle, or its second title, is Il bel far niente, which is Italian. Il bel far niente. And I'm making that up. I mean, I'm making up the, how do you pronounce it, because I don't know Italian. But it sounds kind of Italian, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds pretty good. And I will explain later in the talk what that means. So, if you saw the email that this, and this is part of a three-part series based on one phrase. And the phrase is what I would call a pith instruction or a pith teaching. And that phrase, pith instruction or pith teaching, is used a lot in Tibetan Buddhism, and it refers to a phrase or a few words or a sentence that has an simple and essential meaning to it, simple and essential guidance for you. Kind of like the slogans in AA. So this pith instruction is nothing to do, nowhere to go, and no one to be. And when I say that whole phrase, I'd like you to notice what you experience when I say that. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, and no one to be. And some people might experience kind of a relief or ease or confusion or annoyance, or they don't like it or they like it or whatever. So just notice whatever your response is. And so in this talk, I'm going to go from, in Tibetan Buddhism, they call it, the teachings have an outer level, an inner level, and an innermost level, which means kind of going from the most gross to the most subtle. So I'm going to be approaching this idea of nothing to do from a few different levels. And this idea, this whole phrase, and you might think is meaningful for meditation. Sit down for meditation. Okay, there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, no one to be in a meditation. Or you might think it's relevant to a retreat, a meditation retreat. But my point here is that it's relevant to us all the time, everywhere in our spiritual practice. So you might say there's two types of doing that we do. And the first type is kind of the activity, the conscious doing, the physical movement, the different things that you can witness or see, someone else could witness or see you doing. And that's sort of the outward action, the busyness of activity of our life. And the second level of doing is really the habitual doing of the mind, which is not so visible. But it is what is the motivator, it's what is behind all the outward activity of our life. And this habitual doing of the mind is usually semi-conscious or even unconscious. And that's all the thinking, the worrying, the reacting, the distractedness, the preoccupation, all the things that the mind does. And the various, sometimes it's also the various impulses of the mind. The impulse to keep busy, or the impulse to do a lot, or to hurry from one thing to the next. So I'm going to look at this first from the most outer level. And so if there's this phrase, nothing to do, if that's the instructions, well, how do we do nothing? And what's the value of doing nothing? And how do we do nothing if we're so busy in our lives? Well, it actually begs the question, or questions, What are we doing? And why are we doing what we're doing? And how are we doing what we're doing all day, every day, day after day, for a whole lifetime, over years? So the first level of this is to really begin or continue or deepen our sense of looking at those questions, our paying attention to our doing. Rather than just moving from impulse and unconscious conditioning from the past. And this invites us to begin to apply the basic level of wisdom, the wisdom of discernment, just kind of the first level of wisdom, what one of my teachers calls the kindergarten of wisdom, to begin to look at our doing with discernment, to discern what kind of doing is valuable and what kind is not valuable. What kind of doing, what kind of actions are leading to greater happiness, greater ease, greater freedom, greater open-heartedness, greater connection? And what of our activities are doing, our actions lead to more suffering, more fear, more contractedness, more conflict, more isolation, more suffering? So in paying attention to this whole field of doing, and we're so busy and active, and our culture is just getting more busy and more active, it begins to, I'm encouraging you, again and again, to really see what your choices are and to pay attention to really what your priorities are. And are you living, are your actions in accordance with your true priorities? So in this day and age, often people say they're a little bit too busy to practice. And this is from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah is the famous Thai forest master who was the teacher of Jack Kornfield and many other people. I had the fortune to study a little with Ajahn Chah before he died. And he says, you say that you're too busy to meditate. Do you have time to breathe? Meditation is your breath. Why do you have time to breathe and not to meditate? Breathing is something vital to people's lives. If you see that the Dharma is practice is vital to your life, then you will feel that breathing and practicing the Dharma are equally important. What is the Dharma? Nothing is not the Dharma. So if you really begin to understand in a deep level what the actual practice is, what we're really doing here, what the meditation is leading you to, you know that it is leading you to the here and now, and that in this moment and in every moment is the opportunity to be awake, is the opportunity to see what is true, the opportunity to find freedom. And I'll just mention, I know I've mentioned this here before, but I'll remind you that this brings me too, talking about what I call the doctrine of always practicing, which means when we're doing something, when we're in activity, when we're engaged in whatever we're engaged in, we are practicing something. So we think we're practicing, well, I'm practicing meditation when I sit on the cushion, or maybe I'm practicing some mindfulness here and there. Now, maybe I'm practicing kindness once in a while, and that's our practice. But in reality, we're always practicing. We may be practicing contentment or openness, but we may be practicing worry and anxiety. We may be practicing impatience and irritation. We may be practicing distractedness, anger, So part of this waking up to what we're doing is waking up to what we're really practicing and making a choice about whether we want to be practicing that. This is from Thomas Merton, the famous Trappist monk. And he wrote this in, well, I don't know when he wrote it. He died in 1968, so he wrote it not as late as he could have written it. And this would be, if he saw how things were today, he would emphasize this even more. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicted concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything. So far, familiar? Okay, all those things is itself to succumb to the violence of our times. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to succumb to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything. Is itself to succumb to the violence of our times. Frenzy destroys our inner capacity for peace because it kills the root of inner wisdom. In my mindfulness-based stress reduction class, which I teach at Dominican, we give an instruction, an assignment somewhere about halfway into the course, which is for the students to every day do nothing for 5 to 15 minutes. Not meditate. Not anything. To do nothing. And this is a wonderful exercise, and I recommend it to everyone here. And one thing it does, it gives everyone permission for once in their American life to be unproductive, because people try to be very productive in their meditation as well as everything else. And I particularly recall there was one woman in the course, I mean, a lot of people had different reactions to this exercise, and many people actually liked it. And I particularly remember one woman who this simple exercise actually transformed her whole relationship with life. She liked the meditation and so forth, but it was actually the practice of doing nothing that woke her up to being present. And this is also from Thomas Merton. We are so obsessed with the doing that we have no time and no imagination left for being. As a result, men and women are valued not for what they are, but for what they do and what they have, for their usefulness. So again, this culture that's obsessed with doing and being productive creates a attitude of materialism, of putting value on activity, products, usefulness, rather than on beingness. And this is from Jon Kabat-Zinn, from his book, Wherever You Go, There You Are. The flavor and the sheer joy of non-doing are difficult for Americans to grasp because our culture plays so much value on doing and on progress. Even our leisure time tends to be busy and mindless. The joy of non-doing is that nothing else needs to happen for this moment to be complete. We tend to be operating on an attitude that this moment is incomplete, and that there's something we have to get or have or do or become to make it complete. When you understand non-doing, when you understand true presence, then you understand the fullness and the completeness of whatever is right now. And I couldn't resist from reading some Thoreau. Again, this is a quote you may have heard many times, but over the years it seems even more and more true. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hands. I love a broad margin to my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sing around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands might have been. And having just come back from a month of retreat and not doing a lot for that month, I particularly enjoy that line of, I grew in those seasons like corn in the night. And there is a way when we are just present and learn to just be, there's a kind of natural unfolding that happens. And Thoreau wrote this in Massachusetts, in Malden Pond, in the mid-19th century, just when the Industrial Revolution was taking off, in Massachusetts, actually, in New England. So it was, he was actually rebelling against a bit the beginning of what we are now living with the results of, a culture obsessed with working and long hours and so forth. So in many traditional cultures have an appreciation of this idea of being, of just being. And the French have the phrase joie de vivre, which means joy of living or joy of being alive or joy of just being. And when I gave this talk in Santa Cruz, there's a woman in the Sangha who is French and spends part of her year in France, and she talked about the difference in our culture. When I said this, she talked about the difference in the cultures and how the French don't book themselves up with so many activities and how they can enjoy just sitting in the cafe, essentially doing nothing, and how there's an appreciation of leisure time that is not, again, filled with much of anything. And that brings me to the Italian phrase, il bel far niente, which means the beauty of doing nothing. The beauty of doing nothing. And apparently, il bel far niente has always been a cherished Italian ideal. And I learned about it from Eat, Pray, Love, which some of you may have read. And in there, Elizabeth Gilbert says, the beauty of doing nothing is the goal of all your work in the Italian culture. The final accomplishment for which you are most highly congratulated, the more exquisitely and delightfully you can do nothing, the higher your life's achievement. I like that, isn't it? The more exquisitely and delightfully you can do nothing, the higher your life's achievement. So I decided to put il bel far niente in Google and wanted to see what would come up. And what actually came up were tons and tons of blog entries of people who've read the book Eat, Pray, Love. And I read through a bunch of them, and basically everyone was saying that that idea of the beauty of doing nothing appealed to them, and yet they were way over too busy they had trouble with even beginning to do nothing. And this was a worldwide phenomenon. So there's nothing to do. There's nothing to do to be. There is nothing to do to be. And meditation, our meditation is the practice of being. It's really the simple art of being. It's the essence of what we're doing when we practice. So when you practice, again, do you notice how much doing you're doing in your meditation? How much of your habitual busyness do you bring to your meditation? And how much of the kind of striving, attempting to make something happen, the doing it right, the forcing, the making, watching the breath a project, trying to accomplish? How much of that do you bring to your meditation? The psychologist Winnicott, who, if you've studied psychology, you will be familiar with Winnicott. He wrote some very interesting and useful things about families, children, about the nature of being. And he said, as children in this culture, we aren't given the space to be. We're not allowed to remain, to rest in unstructured states of being. And again, he wrote that quite a while ago, and it's much more true now than when I was growing up. As children in this culture, we aren't given the space to be, not allowed to remain or rest in unstructured states of being. Meaning that we're scheduled, these states of, when we're in unstructured states of being, we're often interrupted, insist that we do something. So as adults, we are uncomfortable with unstructured states of being, and essentially meditation is the practice of unstructured states of being. And because we're not allowed to just rest and be much as children and become uncomfortable with it as adults, we try to fulfill ourselves, that open space, with endless tasks of being enough, of doing enough. And I emphasize endless. Because the task of doing enough and being enough will never end. So there's nothing to do to be free and to awaken. There is nothing to do to be free and to awaken. All along, since we were children, this has been it. This has been it. This right now is enough. Just being is enough. You are enough. There is nothing you need to be free and awaken. You have everything you need. So beingness is just this surrender, this coming to rest in what is. And this surrender and coming to rest in what is where you'll find peace and freedom and ease. So I also like to say we've moved from a doing mentality to one of a kind of dynamic receptivity or a sublime or divine receptivity. A kind of openness to what is, as opposed to trying to fill it up with something else. This is from Lama Suryadas. The awareness practice of meditation attunes us to a receptivity and openness, a way of being that is very useful, even radically transformative. We can listen better rather than telling our stories and talking so much. We can tune into things as they are, receive what is happening and surrender to that, give ourselves up to this process. We don't have to tell it, to push it, to fabricate it, to force it. It is all happening without our interference. That's the meaning of Wu Wei, beyond action and non-action both. So I want to end by talking a little bit about this. It actually comes from Taoism, this expression Wu Wei, or if they actually, the full expression is Wei Wu Wei. And it's the ability to live in action that is beyond action and non-action. To be in activity and doing things in a way that is beyond doing and non-doing. So obviously at this point I'm getting to the more subtle level of understanding. Another way, or an additional way to understand this, is that when we become so present and connected and integrated into what's happening, our action becomes a kind of natural action, a natural responsiveness. And it said, as planets revolve around the sun, they do this revolving but without doing. Or as trees grow, they do the growing but without doing. Thus knowing when and how to act is not knowledge in the sense that one would think now is the right time to do this or that, but rather just doing it, just responding with a natural thing. So you may have some experience of this in different ways and different activities. Sometimes in Western psychology, this kind of thing is described as flow. And many of us have experienced it in things like sports, or I've experienced it in running rapids in a kayak, where you're just so present and connected with what you're doing, with your boat, with water, with the paddle, that you're not thinking, you're just being present and responsive to what's going on. And experience it in dance and other things as well as ordinary life. Sometimes Wu Wei Wu is also translated as doing things without fakeness, which means being fully present, authentic, and real in whatever you do. It means actually being in life without bringing in this extra effort to make things happen, to control things. There's a saying in the Taoist tradition, the Tao abides in non-action, yet nothing is left undone. The Tao abides in non-action, yet nothing is left undone. When I gave this talk in Santa Cruz, someone also used a metaphor in a discussion afterwards, so I'm stealing that, and I'm going to use that here. The metaphor was of a wheel, and that the center of the wheel is what allows the wheel to turn, and yet the center is still. The center isn't doing anything. It's the spokes in the periphery of the wheel that is doing the stuff, and yet it is this still center from which all the spokes and the movement emerges. And as when we practice and come to some place of more interconnectedness and non-separateness, the sense of this false doer falls away. And the idea, the sense that there's someone acting on someone else or something else begins to fall away. And the separate, our separate, isolated, what I call delusional agendas begin to fall away. And we can experience a kind of awake and alive and engaged interconnectedness. A naturalness, an unforced directness, an immediacy. So I'm going to end by reading this spontaneous poem by this Tibetan teacher, Gundun Rinpoche, or at least part of it. Happiness cannot be found through great effort and willpower, but is always already present in relaxation and letting go. Don't strain yourself. There is nothing to do or undo. Whatever arises in the mind has no real importance at all, because it has no reality whatsoever. Don't become attached to it. Don't identify with it and pass judgment upon it. Let the entire game happen on its own, springing up and falling back like waves without changing or manipulating anything. And everything vanishes and reappears magically without end. Only our searching for happiness prevents us from seeing it. It's like a rainbow which you pursue without ever catching. Although it does not exist, it has always been there and accompanies you every instant. Wanting to grasp the ungraspable, you exhaust yourself in vain. As soon as you open and relax this grasping, space is there, open, inviting, and comfortable. So make use of this spaciousness, this freedom and natural ease. Don't search any further. Nothing to do, nothing to force, nothing to want. And everything happens by itself. And it ends with Imaho, which Lama Suridas translates as far out. So I'm going to end here, and we'll just sit silently for a minute or so, and then there'll be a chance to talk and share.